my good horse, I call you my shiny black bears, to the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding,
you're listening to episode 576 of Unwelcome Guests. Is 5,000 years enough? I'm Robin Upton. Now, our subtitle, Debt, Morality and Fiat Currency, gives perhaps a more detailed view of what this show is going to be about. It's in three pieces. In our second hour, we're starting reading of a book by anarchist David Graeber entitled Debt, the First 5,000 Years. Now, he's actually an anthropologist, so he's coming at economics from quite a different angle than most people you've probably heard, and I find his insistence on looking at evidence in the real world to be a very healthy antidote to a lot of the economics make-believe. In our first hour, we're going to hear first from academic and ex-financial regulator Bill Black on systemic financial fraud and his experience, and then we're going to hear Edward Griffin on central banks and issues surrounding money creation. So this is from earlier last month, a section of a listener-supported podcast from peterbcollins.com.
Bill Black returns to our program. William K. Black, if you'd like to look him up at Wikipedia or elsewhere on the web. He is an associate professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. And I give him a lot of credit because he was one of the people on the front lines battling Charlie Keating and the other fraudsters during the savings and loan meltdown of the 1980s. And he was working in the regulatory arena at that time. He published a book about it in 2005, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One, How Corporate Executives and Politicians Looted the SNL Industry. And we got a deja vu frickin' all over again, Bill Black. How are you, sir?
I am well.
First of all, I want to just click over here and listen in to the protests. This is from Washington, D.C., at what they call Freedom Plaza. And about 1,000 people have been gathering there on a daily basis. And they are loosely affiliated with the Occupy Wall Street and occupation efforts across the country. And when I say loosely affiliated, the operation in Washington was set up months ago by activists who tied it to the 10th anniversary of our invasion of Afghanistan. And when the Occupy movement started on Wall Street and spread across the country, the organizers said, well, let's all get together. So there are people in Washington today, and I applaud them for taking to the streets. These are average Americans who have traveled there on their own from all over the country. And while they have been joined by members of organized labor and some other interest groups who protest and work on policy on a regular basis, I do see this as a grassroots and somewhat unwieldy freestanding movement. Bill Black from Kansas City, how does it look to you?
Very much that way. It's, of course, in part modern technology as well. Through things like Twitter and such and the social pages, people are able to organize without really having any orthodox leadership. And that's pretty new to the world. Of course, it means that there isn't a defining message necessarily. But that may not be bad at all. It means that lots of messages get raised and debated and such. And we've had too little debate. We've had too much of TINA. You know, there is no alternative but to do insane things. And
And on that score, I want to underscore what you just said, because I believe that our media and our political leaders present us with a continuing parade of false choices. and we are left, with a kind of untethered position because we scratch our heads and say, well, neither one of these positions makes sense. And so, for example, the whole debate over cutting the deficit, which I consider to be a sideshow distraction to our current problems, has led to the Obama administration and the Democrats adopting the agenda of the far right in this country and the corporate interests. And it's really the corporatism that I think is the common thread. When you hear the interviews with people on Wall Street in Washington and in the other occupations across the country, they have different angles that they take, but they do tend to focus on the abuse of the American nation by corporate power. Would you agree?
I agree, and I agree that the consistent thing in both parties for now 30-plus years has been an acceptance of this corporatism combined with a trashing of anything governmental.
Right. Government can't do anything right. And
yeah.
So we just should dismantle it. And it is so frustrating.
Except, of course, fight wars, send people into fiery buildings, protect your grandmother from the robbers, keep people like me alive when we were young, and my father died very young, and we were on Social Security payments and such. So that's the whole reason I could get an education. So all the things, including education, that government does for us or with us, have been disparaged, and the mindset became, and this was made explicit in the Reinventing Government Act.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff which was Al Gore's passion before the environment, and that the private sector should be the model. So I was there in person to see federal regulators instructed by their superiors that under the Reinventing Government movement, they were to refer to and think of as the industry they regulated as their, quote, clients, unquote.
Yeah,
you can have no more destructive single sentence than that.
Well, and the so-called self-regulation of Wall Street that led to the extremes of the kinds of risk-taking, the clear
risk-taking.
Well,
I'm
about to get to fraud. That was my next statement. Don't worry. I don't think this was just people who lost their compass or went a little bit too far. The whole system was gamed, and I really think that Carl Levin deserves credit for uttering the phrase "shitty deal" repeatedly when he was interviewing a Goldman Sachs executive about the way that they packaged these mortgage-backed securities into tranches, knowing that there was bad product in there, and got them rated AAA, then insured them with AIG so that they could bet against their own clients and still come out ahead.
Well, I think we should owe a great debt to him in many different areas, and I will mention that I was born in Detroit and
mm-hmm.
I was able to vote for him at times. Yes, but here's the good news and bad news about Senator Levin. The good news is that he's done these investigations and that he called a spade in many cases. The bad news is, why did he have to do these investigations? We have massive banking regulatory agencies that are supposed to be in these banks every day of the week. Not the same bank necessarily, but on a continuous basis, we're supposed to be examining them every year. Why haven't they, why haven't the FBI, why hasn't the Justice Department done the investigations? If you go back to the savings and loan crisis, that's what was done. And we, between the 1,000 felony convictions of elite bankers, the roughly 800 civil suits against the elites, and the several thousand administrative enforcement actions against the elites, we put the facts into the public record that the public could judge. And that has not been done except with rare exceptions, and the rare exceptions are folks like Senator Levin. And, of course, it's not occurring at all now in the House, where, you know, except if it's a Democratic embarrassment.
Mm-hmm. Well, and on a broader scale, Bill Black, congressional oversight has become a joke. The responsibilities that committees in the House and Senate have to monitor the actions of various government agencies and investigate as needed really have turned into just one-day sideshows. And nobody has, and this is a bipartisan indictment, when the Democrats were in control of the House, they would hold these kind of one-day sessions where they would bring people in and embarrass them. I remember Brad Sherman asking Detroit Motor executives, you know, raise your hand if you flew here on a corporate jet today. Well, you know, that's interesting and curious, and it's embarrassing for a moment, but it doesn't really address the underlying issues. And at the same time that the congressional oversight has been dialed back substantially, we've seen that the Obama administration has engaged in what has to be a classical kind of obstruction of justice. And maybe it doesn't meet the legal terminology. You're the lawyer here, Bill. But when you look at the big picture, and there have been no serious investigations of wrongdoing in the financial sector, and I also tie it to the failure to investigate torture and other obvious wrongdoing that occurred during the Bush era. And as a package, the Holder Justice Department appears to be disinterested in most of the important investigations. And it's this lack of action that I think feeds this this growing unrest of the American public.
Yeah, it's okay to be disinterested, given that specific definition, but uninterested is real bad, and he's uninterested. So you are quite right. President Obama came in, and one of the things he was proud about was this whole, we're going to be forward-looking, we're not going to look back. Well, if you don't look back at the mistakes that have been made, if you don't hold felons and people that destroy constitutional rights accountable for doing that, then you are not true to your oath of office, which is to defend and support the Constitution of the United States of America and to faithfully execute the laws. Those laws have become a farce if you're an elite. You can violate them with impunity. You can get massively wealthy by fraud. You can kill Americans without any due process in the modern era. That's just a staggering thing.
Yeah,
with no inquiry and such. I mean, I know these are people you hate, but think of what that does in this nation. What's the limit of it? Who is going to be brave enough to even stand up and say, I, as a president, am going to kill the following Americans without any due process?
Mm-hmm.
That is not going to happen. We know this is going to be swept into the shadows and kept there. That's where really bad things happen. So, yes, I long ago called for Holder to be kicked out and replaced with a real attorney general.
And what is holding him back? Does he have instructions from the president? Don't go after Wall Street. Those are my peeps. Those are the people who gave me that early bundled cash that made the difference when I ran for president in 2008. Is it that venal?
There is certainly an element in both, all recent administrations that finance is the leading contributor to both parties and has been for many years. But the problem is more ideological, and it's also simply like we've gone back into the dark ages, you know, when we forgot everything that the Greeks and Romans had learned. So we learned a great deal about how these elite frauds work. We learned how to prosecute them successfully. As I said, we got 1,000 felony convictions of elites, mm-hmm. 90% conviction rate. Listen to the president yesterday. The president yesterday is finally asked, so why are none of the elites that caused this crisis going to prison? And the president says in response, well, you know, bankers I'm sorry, banks are in the business of making profit, so they seek out loopholes. Well, banks don't do anything. People do things, so bankers do things. And if the president hasn't noticed, the bankers weren't seeking profits for the banks. The bankers had the banks make liar's loans, mm-hmm. on which they suffer 50% losses. Why? Because that maximizes the bonus of the executive. Not the loss, but the making of a loan at a premium yield in the short term will goose your accounting stream and create the huge bonuses. And that's why I objected so strongly to your use of the word risk.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Nobel Prize winning economists George Akerlof and Paul Romer got this absolutely right in their 1993 article, Looting the Economic Underworld of Bankruptcy for Profit. If you follow the recipe for accounting fraud, it is a sure thing that you will do three things simultaneously. You will create record fictional short-term reported income.
Mm-hmm.
You will create off-the-charts real bonuses to the top executives, and you will maximize catastrophic losses
mm-hmm.
to the institution. So that's what we have, and here's the question. The FBI warned in September 2004 in open congressional testimony picked up by the national media that there was an epidemic of mortgage fraud, their words, and predicted it would cause a financial crisis, their words, which is exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm.
So I want every major regulator to be asked this question. Tell me the three specific things that were most important that you did in direct response to that warning. And I don't want generalities. I want contemporaneous documents showing that you took these actions to protect the American people. And then I want Holder to explain how we made over a million fraudulent mortgages a year and sold through fraud more than a million a year, and then created CDOs out of them and sold them to the tune of a million underlying mortgages a year. And nobody involved in those frauds, nobody is going to prison.
You didn't hear Bill, it's the predatory borrowers that are at fault
right,
here.
Right, right. It's Ma Jones who purchased her first home, who defrauded the most sophisticated financial institutions in the world.
Well, you know,
yeah,
that
that's
little
a story that makes sense. Let's try that one out as a criminal defense lawyer.
Well, we know how many people carried guns into the mortgage office as they submitted their loan applications and said, "Give me this adjustable rate mortgage that's going to cause my foreclosure in the future, or I'm going to take you out."
Well, that's the key advantage of the NRA. It's all the NRA's fault, apparently.
Well, I mean, we can laugh a little bit about this, but the tragedy is that millions of people continue to face foreclosure. We're not out of the woods on this issue. And meanwhile, we rescued the banks. They continue to pay themselves obscene bonuses. And what really galls me, Bill, is that no effort has been made to recover the bonuses they were paid when they committed fraud, and they knew it. And I can't prove at what point they crossed the line from being shady business people to actual outright fraud, but I know they crossed it at some point, and it is up to, you know, honest investigations to really expose that, and we don't seem to have anybody on duty.
Well, I can tell you when they crossed the line, because nobody who is honest makes liar's loans. And the reason is, if you make loans, mortgage loans, without underwriting, without, in other words, checking, then we have known for centuries that produces what we call in economics incredible adverse selection. You get the worst possible borrowers who aren't going to be able to repay the loans. And we have known for centuries that this means you will suffer catastrophic losses. It is equivalent to going to Las Vegas and betting against the house, except that the odds are vastly, vastly worse.
Mm-hmm.
So when they started making liar's loans, they crossed the line. And by 2006, after the FBI warning, and after the warnings from the industry's own anti-fraud people, which was sent to every mortgage bank in America, the following three statements in writing. One, stated income loans, which is the euphemism, are, and I'm quoting, open invitations to fraudsters. Two, the incidence of fraud in these loans is 90%, 90.
Wow.
Three, these deserve the phrase that the industry uses behind closed doors when it calls them liar's loans. And after all those warnings, the industry massively increased the number of liar's loans it made, such that by 2006, the best estimate is that roughly one out of every three new mortgage loans was a liar's loan. Again, a 90% fraud incident.
Yeah.
That puts you into the millions of cases of fraud per year. And then, when they had caused all this devastation, what happened? You talked about lack of good congressional oversight. I'll give you one that's even worse, because the other thing those committees did, and think of this odd alliance, the Chamber of Commerce, the American Bankers Association, Ben Bernanke at the Federal Reserve, and the new Obama administration worked together, ginned up a hearing of a key subcommittee of House Financial Services, where they brought FASB, the Financial Accounting Standards Board, head in, and they openly extorted him that they would destroy FASB's ability to set rules, which is its only reason for existence, unless FASB changed the accounting rules so that banks did not have to recognize their losses on all these, what Senator Levin aptly called, shitty deals.
Mm-hmm.
And the sole purposes of that are, one, to make the banks appear to be healthier when they're actually, in many cases, insolvent, and two, to allow the CEOs to resume the bonus payments to themselves.
Right. It's insidious. Now, FASB, I thought we formed Peekaboo, the Standards Oversight Group that was supposed to correct the Enron failures. What's the difference between FASB and Peekaboo?
FASB is purely private. Peekaboo has representatives appointed by the United States.
Uh-huh. And do they do the same thing, or which is to say nothing?
No. In fairness, both of them occasionally do good things. They are not, for example, like my profession, law, in which the American Bar Association almost routinely just says, no, hell no, to any reforms.
Uh-huh.
The accounting is inconsistent, which makes them much better.
Well, you know, I never got past generally accepted accounting principles because I always thought that was an insider game that I couldn't play. Bill, with this as backdrop, you wrote a letter more than 6 months ago to the United States Attorney in the Eastern District of California, because Benjamin Wagner had been quoted in the L.A. Times as essentially saying, why should I prosecute these banks? Because they would never have intentionally defrauded themselves, would they? And here's an outright quote from the L.A. Times that you cite in this letter that you wrote to him. Quote, it doesn't make any sense to me that they would be deliberately defrauding themselves. But just a moment ago, in your 3 points, you laid out that fictional profits with heavy bonuses that lead to incredible losses to the institution benefit the profiteers, as our mutual friend Steve Pizzo coined the term. These are financiopaths, sociopaths who manage money or you know, take money.
Yeah, loot.
And so tell me a little bit about this letter that you wrote, and have you ever gotten a response from Benjamin Wagner?
Well, so first, that's the easy part. No response at all from anybody connected with the office. And that office, by the way, is one of the epicenters of mortgage fraud in America. That's Sacramento, California.
Yeah.
So people are suffering enormously because of these frauds. And we have the U.S. attorney, the top prosecutor, who can't even get his pronouns straight. So the way he's using his pronouns, they, the CEO, he says, wouldn't make sense to loot themselves, except themselves is not the CEO, it's the bank. So he thinks they're the same thing. Because he can't conceive that somebody who wears a nice suit could actually be a crook. And if you don't get that much, then you can never be a successful white-collar prosecutor, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, thank God he wasn't dealing with Enron and WorldCom and all those and all the savings and loan frauds, because it's insane, right? Obviously, the CEO does have a strong incentive and ability to loot the corporation and convert the funds of the corporation to his own benefit. So the U.S. attorney just gets none of it right, and he misses at such a basic level that you can understand why there have been no successful even attempts to prosecute out of his office any of the major players in these frauds.
And, Bill, in your letter, this is irresistible. I just have to cite this. You say the industry joke is a rolling loan gathers no loss. And did these banksters, as people like to call them, do you think they had a good sense that bailouts would be available and that they could, run this ship onto the rocks, and that the U.S. government, in the form of taxpayer bailouts, would be there to take care of them?
No, I think they were stunned by that aspect. But you see, you don't need that aspect. Again, that's the whole point of the title, Looting the Economic Underworld of Bankruptcy for Profit. The bank can fail, and the CEO can walk away wealthy. That's the same behind the title of my book that you read, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what in Nolans we would call a laniop, the bailout, a little something extra on the side. I think they were stunned that the United States would suddenly turn the spigots on, A, give them money, B, allow the CEOs that defrauded the institutions to stay in power, C, change the accounting rules so they could hide the losses and start paying D, big bonuses to themselves again. I mean, it's like the old Saturday Night Live, baseball been very, very good to me.
Yeah.
What a great country we live in. And the absolute best part, and this is the investigative journalism of two very good New York Times folks, Gretchen Morgenson and Louise Story, discovered that Geithner, Timothy Geithner, the treasurer of Secretary of the Treasury of the United States,
Right. Discouraged
even investigations of the largest frauds under the grounds that these institutions were fragile and we wouldn't want to impair confidence in them.
Well, and Bill, this whole episode brought out the fundamentalist capitalist in me. And, I've heard all of the talk over the years from the conservatives in this country about personal responsibility and about the rule of law and people who play by the rules, all that bullshit. And to see them just operate in this way that is so arrogant and removed from the American public. They have no sense of any obligation to the country that has permitted them to grab all of this wealth. And at the end of the day, you know, we are left holding the bag, and they're out in the Hamptons having a good old time with champagne and caviar.
Well, you missed the footnote.
Yeah.
Right. The footnote is, we believe in personal accountability and law and order, except if the crooks wear very nice suits.
And have their nails done, I guess. But I believe in bankruptcy. And I think AIG should have been forced into bankruptcy. I think that Citibank should have been nationalized at the point we gave them all that money that was well beyond their market capitalization. And yet, you know, we see that the punches are always pulled for the corporate interests. And the gangsters are really having their way with us.
And that's why we have recurrent, intensifying financial crises. Because we not only do those things, but we put in power, whether it's a Republican or a Democratic administration, the Paulsons of the world, if they're Republicans, or the Rubens and Summers of the world, if they're Democrats, and Geithners, mm-hmm. if they're either Republicans or Democrats. And these people all have the same mindset, and that is, they literally believe that fraud cannot occur in financial markets. That financial markets are efficient and self-correcting, and that financial markets can't have crises. Now, none of this has anything to do with observable reality.
Yeah.
All of it has been shown to be false time after time after time. But these are what we call theoclassical economists. It is a religion for them. And many of them are in their 50s and 60s. What are they supposed to say? I'm sorry. Everything I've taught for 30 years was a lie. I have no useful contribution to make to the world. You should burn all my books, you know, before they mislead further people. That's never going to happen, right? That's not how human beings operate. So they will hang on, and they will defend to their dying breath this, no matter how insane it becomes. And because they keep being put in power, regardless of the administration, they produce disaster after disaster. I mean, I was actually asked by Marketplace about this Geithner line about financial stability, and I said, yeah, you know, apparently regulators are much more clever these days than in our era. We had never figured out that leaving frauds in charge of our most elite financial institutions was the way to achieve financial stability.
It well,
would have been so much easier just to stand back and let them continue to run the place.
Well, it is like hiring a bank robber to run security at a bank. They know how to get in. So, Bill, recently you wrote an open letter to the Attorney General of California, Kamala Harris, who opted out of the joint task force approach. They were going to settle with the offenders here without any serious investigations or accountability. And Ms. Harris, I think, exercised good judgment in taking California out of that that settlement group. Talk a little bit about what was underway and how her action might change that.
Okay, so first a caveat. We don't really know exactly what was underway because the settlement discussions are secret. And so there are various leaks, and you know the problem with relying on leaks. Here's what we do know. First, New York Attorney General Schneiderman, and then Delaware Attorney General Biden, and yes, that is a relative.
Mm-hmm.
And note that those are two of the absolute most important states. New York,
Delaware is the huge corporate charter
exactly.
center. Yeah.
And now California, by far the largest of the states, have all said no, hell no. And so their concern is that there, as you say, there haven't been investigations of massive areas of fraud for the reasons we've talked about, because the federal government has simply not done it. And the federal government has unbelievably more resources than do all 50 states combined to investigate white-collar crime. Okay, so A, there hasn't been an investigation. B, the lawyers, and remember, this is one of the difficulties. We are always up against the best criminal defense lawyers in the world when we take on these elite white-collar criminals. And so these lawyers were very critical. And they said, hey, if we're dealt lemons, this civil suit, why don't we make Dom Perignon? So they said, we'll cut a deal with you in which you give you some money, because we don't care about money, unless it gets really, really big. And the money being talked about is chicken feed. It's both large in most human terms and chicken feed for these financial institutions. So we'll buy you off with money, and you'll agree not to investigate whole big areas that will give us de facto immunity even from criminal prosecution down the road. That's a great deal. And some of the state attorney generals have been more sympathetic to that. And unfortunately, the federal government has been extremely sympathetic. And so most notoriously, you had one of the vice chairs of the board of directors of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York attacking the attorney general of New York at a funeral. Immediately after a funeral they both attended, for how dare he go after the leading employers.
Well, you know, the Supreme Court lifted any sense of propriety about what you do at funerals now, so.
Well, remember, these are conservative people that are dismayed at the degradation of American culture and values,
mm-hmm,
unless,
right,
of course, they're leading it.
Yeah. Or there's money at stake.
Well, that's when they lead.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So by opting out, what happens next? Will California then align with other opting out states and try to form a second group?
Well, what she said is that she was going to put emphasis on the task force that she had created to investigate from soup to nuts the frauds. So the frauds start in the origination process and the appraisal process, but then overwhelmingly liar's loans, of course, were sold. And they were sold through false reps and warranties, so that's an additional layer of fraud. And they were packaged as if they were AAA, so that's an additional level of fraud. And then they were sold to people under false reps and warranties, so that's an additional level of fraud. And then the people that purchased them didn't recognize losses on them under the accounting rules prior to the gimmicking that I talked about, and that's fraud.
Mm-hmm.
So you have at least five levels of fraud before you get to the foreclosure fraud, which is the context of this global settlement that we've been discussing. Mm-hmm. So that's actually the sixth level of fraud.
So on that basis, should Angelo Mozillo, the former CEO of Countrywide, should he be lawyering up and buying a little place in Paraguay?
Oh, I'm sure he's already lawyered up long ago, and you don't have to go to Paraguay, unfortunately. All you have to do is go to Florida and buy an Uber mansion.
Yeah.
Because Florida has weird laws that protect, even when it's the proceeds of a fraud. It's quite amazing.
That is amazing. Well, Bill, I want to thank you for your longtime support of the rule of law, honesty in our banking institutions. And I appreciate you sharing with us the history of the SNL investigations and convictions from the 1980s, because it sets a standard that, shows just how shameful the current administration is in bypassing the obvious wrongdoing that occurred. And it's an opportunity on a political basis that the administration is missing, because they've seized on this recent step by Bank of America to charge $5 a month for debit card users, which is a payback of the Dodd-Frank lukewarm effort, the tepid attempt to re-regulate these financial institutions. And the Obama administration wants to distract us with that when billions, if not trillions of dollars, have been looted from average Americans, and his administration is asleep at the deputy's desk.
Yeah, we're talking about losses estimated by the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission to this nation of $11 trillion. That's with a T. A trillion is a thousand billion.
Yeah. Bill Black, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Take care.
Now, we're now going to hear a section from a tape produced by G. Edward Griffin. I think this is from the 1980s, about central banks and fiat currency. So it's not up to date, but the details haven't changed, and I think he gives a great explanation of the mechanics of inflation and the money creation process. Now, he is a gold bug. I think Ron Paul's also a gold bug. A listener alerted me to that, is thinking that we should be replacing fiat money by gold-backed currency. Now, I see problems with this, but I won't go into them, but that's to explain why it starts in this rather unexpected fashion with the claim that no fiat currency system has ever survived in history. Now, this is slightly self-justifying claim, because if it has collapsed, then okay, that one's collapsed. If it hasn't collapsed, we say, well, it's going to collapse in the future. Now, I don't argue with the premise that fiat currency is inherently unstable and requires that people have some kind of credence in those who issue it, which I think we understand is hitting an all-time low. I think what will actually kick it off will be the arrival of alternative systems. Although, as we shall hear in a second hour, the very concept of the need for money and an economy is something of a modern fiction. So this is Edward G. Griffin, I think, from the 1980s.
And that is why fiat money self-destructs. The mechanism is called inflation because so much money is being created that it begins to exceed the value of all goods and services in the society, and this gap gets wider and wider. Yes, you're producing more goods, more services are available, and the cost of producing these things is going down because of improved technology. All of that is on the good side, but on the other side, the monetary scientists and the political scientists are creating money more than enough to offset that gain. And the gap gets wider and wider and wider and wider until finally the cost in terms of those dollars they're creating becomes exorbitant. That's inflation, and that is the destruction of the monetary system. And I call that the Dillinger mechanism. Now, why do I call it the Dillinger mechanism? The reason is that this is more than just inflation. We think of inflation as the erosion of our dollars, purchasing power, rising prices, and all that sort of thing. But ladies and gentlemen, when you really analyze this mechanism, it is far more than that. It is the transfer of wealth. What happens as the result of inflation is the transfer of wealth from most of the people in the middle class to a few people in the upper class. I hate to use the word upper class, but to a few people at the very top of the economic spectrum. It is not only the transfer of wealth, it is the theft of wealth. And I think calling it the Dillinger mechanism after the well-known prohibition gangster John Dillinger is appropriate. I'd like to digress on the subject of inflation just for a second, because it will give us an insight into what I believe is directly ahead here in America. Classical economists such as Ludwig von Mises has explained that inflation always takes a course that can be identified through three phases. Now, there's no demarcation between one phase and the other. It's just you know when you're there. You may not know when you got there, I mean, what point you stepped over the line, but when you're firmly in the middle of it, you know that you're there. The first stage is what might be called moderate inflation, phase one. Now, in this phase, the government is expanding the supply of money greater than the expansion of goods and services, but there's little or no public expectation of the impact that this is going to have on prices. We've seen this happen over and over and over again. As a matter of fact, it's happening right now. Right now. The government is expanding the money supply at a very substantial rate, but people are not raising their prices for their labor or their goods because they don't expect anything to happen as a result of it. We've had a period of moderate inflation, a period of stability, and so nothing's happening. We'll just keep going as we are. So there is true inflation in terms of the expansion of the money supply, but there is no inflation in terms of rising prices. The reason the rising prices are lagging is because of public expectation, psychological factors only. And that is phase one. Now, phase two happens when the public begins to wake up to the fact that, hey, money is easier, I can get more money for my goods, I can borrow more, I can expand, things are costing me more now a little bit, I better raise my prices, and whoops, maybe I better begin to figure in a little inflation in all my calculations for the future. They begin to say, well, I want to earn 6% on my money. But inflation is running at 6%, so if I want to make 6%, I guess I better insist on 12%. This is phase two. When the public begins to realize the gain and begins to calculate on it continuing, now prices start catching up with inflation, and as a matter of fact, they exceed inflation. They pass inflation by. It's sort of a pendulum action or a catch-up reaction, springboard action. Now, this is very, very unnerving to the government because all of a sudden they're not having the advantage of creating money out of nothing because prices are going up faster than they're creating money, so they start to accelerate their creation of money to get ahead of public expectation. This always happens. When that happens, now you're getting toward the end of phase two, and by the time you get into phase three, which generally is called hyperinflation, phase one, by the way, might be called moderate inflation. Phase two might be called double-digit inflation. And phase three, hyperinflation. In phase three, the prosperity effect has been nullified by the expectation effect. See, people have been enjoying this prosperity of inflation, but now the expectation effect is becoming so large that people begin to say, wait a minute, this money is getting more and more worthless. I better get out of money and into tangibles. Now they rush out and they buy a new car, they'll buy hardware, television sets, they'll buy silverware, they'll buy gold coins, they'll buy extra real estate, they'll just get rid of whatever money they have because they know that their money is going down so rapidly, they're going to get into tangible assets. There's a flood of this sort of thing happening, there's a rush away from money, and when that happens, the value of money really plummets then, because of psychological factors. In addition to the inflation on the part of the government, you've got the mechanism on the part of the government on one hand, the psychological factors on the part of the population on the other, and these two combined absolutely make money worthless in a society. Where this has happened historically, we won't take time to talk about it, you're probably familiar with the classical experience in Germany, the value of the mark, the value of whatever the unit might be in that country, plummets to absolute zero. And those who are holding on to those marks or those pesos or those dollars or whatever they're called, they're wiped out. Anyone who has money at the end of this phase is destroyed, at least to the extent of the money that he holds. Now, toward the end of this cycle, the government always responds to hyperinflation by creating a new money supply. Now, this is a pretty good trick. For most of the population, it works once or twice. The officials say to the people, well, yes, we have a real economic problem here. The money is becoming worthless, so we're going to get rid of that old money, that bad money, and we're going to replace it with new good money. And the average, person says, oh, golly, my government is really taking charge. They're going to solve this problem. They don't realize that these are the jerks that caused the problem in the first place. They really think that these people are going to solve the problem. So they believe it. Many people believe it. Most people believe it. The ones who don't want to think negative thoughts, the ones who like to think about a rosy future, they believe it. So they issue the new money supply. It's usually a different shape, different color or something. And they usually multiply the factor so that you turn in 10 of your old units and you get one unit back. Or maybe you turn in 100 of your old units and you get one unit back. And that works pretty good because people say, gee, I've got all this worthless money. I turn in and now I get one unit will buy as much as 10 of those old units. And they think that somehow that made them richer. It's amazing. This has always happened. So this happens, the new money comes out, and then finally the same process continues and the public realizes, well, wait a minute, nothing's changed. The new money hasn't changed anything. And they start getting rid of that. And in some cases, the government will try the new money switch again, a second time, but usually the second time it has less impact on the population, but it prolongs the final day of reckoning. Now, as I said a moment ago, the result of inflation is the destruction of the middle class. The acquisition of all the wealth that was held by the middle class is now in the hands of the financial leaders of the world or the nation, and in the hands of their financial institutions which they control. It may not be in their name, but they control the financial institutions that in turn acquire the property. And people wind up now renting, in essence, renting the property they once were trying to own. And they are, in fact, serfs to the landholders. Now, one of the best overviews of the effects of inflation was given to us by, you can never believe it, John Maynard Keynes. Now, he's a man who should know, because it was Keynes who advanced many of the economic doctrines that make inflation inevitable. And it was he, for example, who advocated government debt as the path to national prosperity, and it was he who labeled gold as old-fashioned and a barbaric relic. But nevertheless, this is what Keynes said in his book, The Economic Consequences of the Peace. Quote, "By a continuous process of inflation, governments can confiscate secretly and unobserved an important part of the wealth of their citizens. There is no subtler, no surer means of overturning the existing basis of society than to debauch the currency. The process engages all the hidden forces of economic law on the side of destruction, and does it in a manner which not one man in a million is able to diagnose." End quote. And that is the truth. Fiat money makes the destruction of the monetary system inevitable. I want to repeat that point, because we have fiat money today, and the money we have today will self-destruct. There is no question about that, at least in my mind, and anyone who has seen the historical overview of this cannot deny the fact. There's nothing different. In fact, things are worse today. There's less understanding of money today than there ever was on the part of the people. There's less restraint on the part of the political scientists and the monetary scientists today than there ever was in history. And all of the forces that are at work today that have always been at work in the past. And I'm saying to you that if you don't believe that our money is going to self-destruct, well, good luck. Now let's talk about the duck dinner mechanism. I remember hearing the story of a farmer who had a pond out behind his barn. And of course, in the summertime, there was always a good flock of ducks there. And he would go out with his shotgun in the morning and get a few of them, and all summer long he would have duck dinner. But he was unhappy because in the fall these ducks would take off for warmer climes and no duck dinner during the winter. And then he got the idea that if he started putting out grain for the ducks and making it easy for them to find food during the summer, and especially in the fall, maybe they would hang around. And sure enough, they did. You know, a free lunch. See how it worked? You all came, didn't you? So anyway, the ducks hung around. And some of them didn't go south in the fall. And this happened a couple of years in a row, and by that time the flock got larger and larger every winter until finally they were all hanging around. And wouldn't you know, the farmer had duck dinner all winter. Well, something very similar to that is happening and always has happened in the economic marketplace. You make things very easy for people, unnaturally easy economically, make credit unnaturally easy. If you make gaining wealth unnaturally easy, you're going to lure people into an unnaturally precarious position to the point where they may not be able to fly when they have to. And so I call this the duck dinner mechanism, the lure of easy credit, the lure of low interest rates, the availability of large sums of money, and the example of looking at your neighbors and your friends, and they're all making it in the stock market or speculative investments, or they're buying real estate, and you know their value of their estate is going up, and the guy next door buys himself a big RV on the other side. He has a big boat that's sitting in his driveway, and your wife looks at you and she says, "Honey, are we doing this right? You know, you're still saving your money and not getting in over your head." People are leveraging their credit, and they're making money on what they owe. And so this lures all the ducks out, hang around, to get into an unnatural position where they have so much debt that they can't fly. And then, of course, when the contraction of the economy happens, they lose everything, or almost everything. The saw moves in two directions, if I may use that analogy. You know, a saw has teeth pointing in one direction. When you pull it toward you, it doesn't cut. It's just getting ready for the cutting stroke. And then when you push it, it takes all the wood with it. Now, the saw will not cut if it just sits in one place. You need to pull it and push it, pull it and push it. And this is what we see happening in the economy over and over again. Expansion of the money supply, easy credit. Contraction of the money supply, tight credit. Expansion of the money supply, easy credit. Contraction of the money supply, tight credit. And what happens in each cycle, each stroke of the saw, a lot of people get cut out. And it just depends on how far they cock the saw and how many times they strike it. Each time the saw moves, it takes with it some people in the middle class. Now let's talk about the mandrake mechanism. This is the question of how does money actually come into being? Perhaps the most mysterious, quote unquote, of all of these subjects, because it is shrouded with all kinds of words which do not mean what you think they mean. Words which have special meanings which are unknown to the average person. Words which are thrown out there deliberately, in my opinion, deliberately to confuse and to deceive. I call this the mandrake mechanism after the comic strip magician during the 1940s. Mandrake the magician had a specialty of creating things out of nothing. He was very good at that. He also was pretty good at making things disappear back into nothing. Now we're talking about the central banks and the creation and the destruction of money. Now, we're not talking about commodity money here or promissory money. Those things are money of the past. We're talking about today's money, fiat money. The first thing to understand about the mandrake mechanism is that the government does not simply print it. There's a lot of confusion on this point. People have the image that when the government creates money, all they do is just pick up the phone and call the Treasury Department or the Bureau of Engraving and say, "Turn on the press, fellas, we need some more $1,000 bills." That is not how it happens. It could happen that way, and there are periods in history where governments have tried that, but generally it's a very unpopular move because it's awfully obvious. It's direct. You know, people can understand that. You can realize that the presses are turning out money, and you see a lot of money in circulation, and you see inflation, and look who's to blame. It's the guy with the button on the printing press, and that's the government. That's easy. So they don't do that so much anymore. Far more sophisticated approach.